Welcome to The Inner Game. I'm Gwen Garcelon, your host. Thanks for listening. The Inner Game is about how we nurture our mind, body, spirit health, and how that deepens our relationship to our purpose and to the contribution we want to be in bringing forth a more beautiful world. These are conversations with people who are committed to making an evolutionary difference with their lives from a place of balance and love and service. Last year, I began inviting past guests back to the podcast to check in on how they are relating to all that's going on in the world and the challenges afoot, and how their spiritual lives are providing resiliency and agency, two things we need in increasingly big ways. Today, I am excited to welcome back a treasured friend, Robert Egger. Let me just make sure. There we go. Robert is an award-winning social entrepreneur and food system thought leader, humanitarian, speaker, pioneer, and advocate for the creativity and power of the nonprofit sector, and the author of Begging for Change. And I just am thrilled to have you here, Robert.
Oh, hey, Big G. Cool to be here with you.
I am not hearing you super well, so if you can get as close to your phone as possible, that would be great.
Well, I hope this is better.
That is better, yes.
Life is good.
All right. Thanks so much for being here.
Oh, I'll go anywhere to be with you, friend. You're one of my favorite people.
Ah, that makes me happy. Well, I would love to hear about how you are approaching the added challenge that just kind of keeps you know, increasing in our lives these days. How are you approaching it? What are the stories you're telling yourself?
Well, I mean, I've always been an incredibly fortunate human. So I can always fall back on that idea of like, look, dude, your life is pretty darn good, so don't sweat it. But it does affect me when I think there are people who aren't nearly as fortunate as I have been, who can't sweat it, you know, cannot sweat it. They're kind of stuck where they're at, having to deal with life that comes at them. So a lot of my life has really been about how can I use the things I have, whether it's my brain, my imagination, my speaking ability, to do things for others that might lessen that load.
And do you feel like there's something about how we're wired for service? Because, you know, when you look at all of the greats, you know, spiritual leaders and social justice leaders, their lives at the end of the day are all about service. And I'm wondering if there's something in that really, that we're wired for, that, you know, we're sort of incomplete without that kind of relationship with one another.
Well, you know, one of the quotes we've heard a lot is this notion that I think Elon Musk has put out, that, you know, empathy is a sucker's bet. And I think, you know, I've always been in service, whether it was working in nightclubs or the DC Kitchen, World Central Kitchen. But I've also studied independence leaders. And I think a lot of the people you would associate with both your thought and this idea of independence leaders, whether it's a Mahatma Gandhi, a Cesar Chavez, a Sojourner Truth, a Martin Luther King, many of them were thrust into their life. You know, they didn't seek it. Dr. King was a junior minister who the elders of Montgomery kind of said, give it to the young guy. Let him be the guy who must take the blows for instigating these bus boycotts. You know, Cesar Chavez was a worker. Gandhi was, you know, a humble lawyer to make his way in South Africa when he saw firsthand after coming there from England, the inconsistency of British law would have led to people of color in South Africa. So I do believe that we are born empathetic beings, but I think sometimes the necessity to become bigger than yourself is thrust upon us by circumstances.
Mm. Robert, I'm just going to ask if there's any other way we can get your audio to be more clear, because it's still a little bit shaky, and I want people to hear what you have to say.
Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, this is one of the problems with being in rural New Mexico. This is, I think, as good as we're going to get
okay.
for Cerritos, New Mexico.
Okay.
I'll speak up, hopefully. Maybe I'll speak up, and that'll help.
Okay. We'll soldier on. You know, part of this show is to really dig into something that doesn't get discussed very much, and that's our spiritual life, the ways that we're evolving and growing as human beings personally, and how that helps us make a bigger difference in the world. And I'm wondering if you would talk a little bit about your experience of your spiritual life and how that's shown up for you in how you serve. What do you think, how do you think it's helped you make a bigger difference?
Well, you know, like many people, I was raised going to church. And, you know, it's funny because I consider myself spiritual, but I was very much informed by going to church, and in particular, in the Catholic church, there was a sermon every year, and I was always intrigued by the way you heard sometimes the same stories annually. I mean, you know, there's a finite number of stories, and I was intrigued about how different priests would interpret those stories, and really kind of challenge you to see a broad spectrum of the ways in which they could be interpreted. And that really stuck with me because, you know, as I grew older, I really replaced kind of religion in my life with music. I was, as a child of the 60s, I loved music. And the stories that I heard through a Bob Dylan or a Bob Marley or a John Lennon or a variety of other amazing artists really fed my spirituality at the same time, but infused it with social action. That idea that, you know, you can't just sit back and hum hymns or, you know, kind of groove to Bob Dylan. You had to put those feelings into action. And equally, I think we grew up at a time, or at least I did, when, you know, there were a lot of really tragic murders, you know, whether it was RFK, you know, and Martin Luther King 2 months apart when I was 9 years old. And that idea of you can't let dreams die with the men. You know, you have to find a way to get a new generation to hear the same call for justice. I originally thought I was going to do it in a nightclub with music, but then I started the DC Central Kitchen, mainly because no one else would. I didn't want to do it. But as the kitchen grew and became popular and attracted people, I discovered that food could be my music and a kitchen could be my nightclub. And that's the way, you know, I approached it. How can I use the simple joy of cooking a meal for others to be a profound political idea?
I love that. Maybe say a little bit about the DC Kitchen model for people who haven't heard about the Central Kitchen model and why that's more and more important. Like, how is that model emerging and unfolding as time goes on?
You're so kind to ask. I mean, I'm very lucky in that I had an original idea, and it was born out of a night volunteering on a rainy night in front of the White House, where I joined a group of people with love in their hearts, going out to serve people on the streets a meal. And I was struck because while the act in and of itself was beautiful, I was in a warm truck, and the people who were receiving food were out in the rain. And that really struck me as kind of a grand illustration of the flawed dynamic of charity, which, as I said before, is based more on the redemption of the giver and not the liberation of the receiver.
Mm.
So on the way home, I just innocently said to my wife, Claudia, or my fiance at the time, you know, somebody, the restaurants, the hotels, the hospitals, farmers have tons of food left over that they don't want to see thrown away. If you could find a health code approved, safe way to collect that food, wow, you could feed more people better food for less money. But those same people have jobs. And so many of the people I encountered on the street that night were much more lucid and joyful and human than I really thought in my flawed vision of who is homeless in America. So I said, well, even better, why don't we start a cooking school for the homeless, for people home from prison, and we will be able to shorten the line by the way we serve it, by offering people a chance to come in out of the rain and be part of the solution. And that idea of let's empower people while we, while we reprocess all the donated food into balanced meals. And ultimately, I think the bigger leap was when we decided let's offer volunteers a chance to come in and help. And we'll, instead of the old model where volunteers would, kind of in a Thanksgiving-esque system, will serve homeless people a piece of turkey with a table, dividing them. You know, they'd be aligned on one side, and then they'd go down and people would serve them a meal. I said, let's do it side by side. Let's explore what it would be like for people who might be old and want to stay active. You know, young people who want to get service hours to graduate school. And in the case of D.C. Central Kitchen, let's get presidents of the United States who want to show what 1,000 points of light looks like, or what an empathetic citizen looks like. And they would come down. And that idea of presidents standing next to people in a job training program and working side by side, that really lit a lot of fire. So now there are hundreds of community kitchens that are loosely based. I mean, I was always open source. Whatever I had, I was going to give away. So, you know, there are many. And then, of course, my great friend Jose Andreas, we started World Central Kitchen together about 14 years ago, and that's led to the distribution of about 500 million meals in disaster areas around the world.
And I love that piece of giving a, offering a training program to people in prison, or when they've been released from prison, you know, because it's hard to find jobs. And what a beautiful way to give folks like that a new start.
But, you know, it demanded more than just kind of a giving heart because, for example, when computerized job application systems came in the late 90s and early 2000s, if you checked a box on a computerized application for a job and you said, you know, you checked the box that said, have you ever been convicted of a felony, you never got an interview. So that forced us to adapt and evolve, and we started our own business to demonstrate clearly, look, we're hiring people who've been out of prison. We're paying a living wage. We're providing benefits. We also, at the time, had started buying food from local farmers, and that allowed us to really not only develop our own unique new business model, but again, demonstrate conclusively that so many of the things that the larger society were skeptics thought were impossible. Oh, I can't hire a felon or someone who was an addict. Oh, if I pay a good wage, I'll lose money. Or buying food from local farmers is too difficult. We did all of that and more. So, you know, that idea of kind of aggressive empathy, aggressive joy, is a lot of what I embraced.
I love that. So for those just joining, this is Gwen Garcelon, and you're listening to The Inner Game on KDNK. I'm talking with Robert Egger about, you know, this is something I'd really love to get into now, is the security of living your values. You know, this is such an insecure world that we live in. And it's been my experience that because I've kind of lived outside the box for most of my adult life, that the real security comes from living a life that's aligned with your values. That's an expression of your soul's purpose. And I feel like when you're doing that, the universe kind of lines up to support you and finds a way forward. And I wanted you to talk a little bit about that because I think, you know, especially even for young people who are coming into adulthood, you know, and looking for like, what do I do? And the importance, the possibility of living a life deeply aligned with your values.
You know, Gwen, for the young people in your audience, I've often said nobody wakes up when they're 20 and looks in the mirror and says, when I grow up, I'm going to be a boring bureaucrat that stifles innovation. Yet the world is full of them. And how did they become that? How did a fiery young person who wanted to change the world give up? And I've become intrigued by that. And so just as you might find balance in exercise or being outdoors, that idea of a daily exercise that keeps you true to your dreams, you know, whether it's developing friendships with people who are honest with you. Now, you know, it's funny, Glenn, because throughout my career, I purposely experimented with ideas about what is leadership. So, for example, many times in my career, I was not the highest paid person at businesses that I started. And I think that's counter to the theory of, oh, you know, I'm the boss, I get the biggest paycheck. But where is that written? And that idea of experimenting constantly with ideas, where is that written? That's almost been a motto for me, a mantra throughout my life. You know, who says? Where is that, you know, where is that rule written down? And wherever it is, F it, you know? I don't have to listen to it. So, you know, that idea of purposely trying to stay true to who I wanted to be when I was 10 years old. I mean, I mentioned earlier that I was 10 when Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King were assassinated. And that really, I chose the team I wanted to play on. And that idea of never losing that edge, and again, purposely setting out to challenge myself, you know, to remain true. So that idea, I think, of I would urge any of your listeners to that idea of how do you, throughout your daily life, challenge yourself, remind yourself, or reward yourself for being that person you set out to be.
Hmm. So what have been the rewards of living life how you have? You know, with challenging the status quo and doing things differently and risking a lot.
Well, there have been both rewards and there have been failures. I mean, you know, as you know, I went out to Los Angeles to open the L.A. Kitchen with the idea of being a pioneer, a joyful sojourner about what does a senior meal of the future look like. You know, every single morning, 10,000 people wake up, 70 in America. And many of them, going back to our previous conversation about life and value, many look in the mirror and almost sigh, thinking, how did I get so lost? How did I get tricked into believing if I just bought more stuff, I'd be happy? And so many of them are trying so hard to find their way back to the garden, not back to the 60s, but back to that sense of who they wanted to be. That's why, again, I really challenge lovingly your younger listeners to really decide for yourself what is your version of happiness, not what your parents think, not what society tells you, what do you think? Now, for me and some of the rewards I've been able to I should finish that thought by saying that I went up to L.A. and I had to close L.A. Kitchen because people who were in charge of senior systems didn't want to be challenged. They didn't want new systems or a new meal structure that kind of did away with the tyranny of the four-compartment tray. And I had to close. That was the first time in my life that chasing my dream didn't work. So it's important to acknowledge that sometimes it doesn't. But I have, as I sit back here in fuzzy New Mexico, where I hope you can still hear me semi-okay, I am blessed with a myriad of friends, including you. I have a wife and I, with my wife Claudia and I, are going to celebrate our 42nd wedding anniversary. Our daughter Julia is getting married and was kind enough to ask me to officiate her wedding in our backyard in May. I just officiated the wedding of my best friend since kindergarten. A guy I've known for 60 years asked me if I'd officiate he and his beloved wife's new friendship, new love, new pledge. So, you know, those kind of friendships, that kind of love, and frankly, the very simple life we lead here is an amazing reward.
Mm. You know, I'd like to ask my guests, what's a growth edge for you right now? You know, what's something you're working on in yourself or, you know, in your relationship to the world that's causing you to keep growing and expanding?
I think many of your listeners can probably sympathize with my daily eruption of profanity and anger as I watch the America I grew up loving changing for what I think the worse. And to avoid that, the pitfall or the quicksand of that emotion, I have got myself an e-bike. Now, I was a runner for the longest time in my youth, and I almost have to get outside once a day. And when I was young and building DC Kitchen and other kitchens, and I would run into frustrating people or gatekeepers or, you know, the tyranny of routine, my running would give me the ability on the way out to forgive my enemies, to ponder what I could have done differently. And, of course, on the way back, I was plotting their death again. So it wasn't a complete, you know, a panacea for what ails you. But I found it very soothing. And then as I got older, I became a walker, a purposeful walker, but I would walk. And I would take everything in. You know, I try never to be a passive liver. You know, I'm always studying and looking and kind of tilting my head to see the world a little bit askew. But then as my knees gave it out and I thought my disease would pass, and frankly, when I was putting on some pounds in my 60s, I went out and got myself an e-bike. I hadn't been on a bike in probably, honestly, 50 years. And a friend of mine challenged me to get on his e-bike. We all have friends that you might as well just submit, because they're going to badger you until you do what they want you to do. But I got on and I loved it. So now every day I go out and I take a ride up in the Ortiz Mountains, right behind our little village of Cerrillos here, and I am reborn. I am rejuvenated. I am relieved, and I'm happy. So that's what I do.
Mm. Yeah, I feel like our rebuilding our connection to the natural world, you know, that relationship that's always been so central to us as human beings, and that has been eroded by the way we live these days, it is kind of our way back. You know, it's such a universal way that people connect to their spiritual life. And it's a reminder of beauty in the world. We need that so desperately.
I agree. You know, and I do at times where I think you and I grew up in an age where there still was, you know, you could get on your bike in most places and find those things you didn't know existed. And that was because our parents threw us out of the house and said, don't come back until lunchtime or when the sun's going to go down. And we were free. And more importantly, we had our imagination. It was pre-internet, you know, everything that keeps you kind of muzzled. So, you know, I worry that for a younger generation who's never had kind of the glorious solitude of walking in a desert or on a mountaintop or next to a lake, you know, I worry that they haven't experienced that stuff. That I think people of our generation, every walk rekindles so many memories of our lifetime. And so I think for any parent out there, and I know probably within your listenership, most of the people listening are bad advocates for outdoor life.
Yeah.
But you know, even if it's opening up your house to somebody, in fact, that's one of the things we do now. I was lucky to travel a lot when I was young. So we have a guest house, and we make it available for all our friends and family. And pretty much three times a month, there's someone here. And just recently, we had two boys, 9 and 11, who were their first time kind of out west. And next weekend coming up, we have another friend with a 12-year-old boy. And it's kind of a joy to take kids out to right near where we live. There's a whole wall of petroglyphs. And to see a young kid to be able to get up close and sit where a native child might have sat 1,000 years ago and scratched out a rough circle over a dragonfly or a star, and just watch their faces kind of light up as they time trip, that really is something that I get a lot of joy from, exposing people to that kind of life and that kind of beauty and joy.
Yeah. It's universal in, the awe that we experience in those kinds of situations.
Good word. Awe is a great word. I like awe. I seek out awe in my life.
Yeah, it's something I've been teaching for a while, too, awe as a practice. I just thank you so much for being here today, Robert. Thank you all for listening today. If you have a question for Robert or me, you can join the Facebook page at The Inner Game. We'd love to hear your feedback and ideas. And until next time, consider that nurturing your spiritual life may be your greatest evolutionary contribution right now. See you next time. Winds are restless, trees are patient.